It is my great pleasure to welcome, I think for the first time, to this stage in Many Rivers when we move everything back. He has been a regular visitor to and supporter of Many Rivers in many ways. And Stuart and I, of course, had the distinct pleasure of speaking with our speaker, Gustav Zaraga, and our radio show of Mystical Positivist not too long ago, and you can find that on the web if you want to listen to that podcast. But I was the lucky recipient of the opportunity to read a lot of his work in preparation for that interview, and I've known him for a while and have also known that Dr. De Zaraga is a very witty, smart guy. The interview that we did revealed that he has depths that I did not at that time suspect. I have no doubt that all of that and more will be laid before you tonight. And no expectations.
No pressure.
And we are delighted to welcome Dr. Gustav Zaraga to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
That's a lot to live up to. Witty and smart is, of course, a very polite way of saying wise ass.
I also forgot to mention his books, many of which are over here. I'll talk about those later at the end.
And the book that in many ways underlies this talk is going to come out next month with Quest, called Fault Lines, the 60s, the Culture War, and the Return of the Divine Feminine. So I'll be happy to sign it, but I can't sign it tonight. I'm a political scientist by training, and went to Berkeley, got my PhD, and thought I was going to live a normal life as an academic scholar, writing papers mostly read by other academic scholars, until literally days after getting my dissertation, I dared someone, because I knew who couldn't, to show me magic. He did. Shattering my worldview in one evening on the UC campus, and leading into now 25 years or so of study in neo-pagan and shamanic and some African diasporic spiritual traditions with a little smattering of Buddhism for taste. And for a long time I wondered, how does this fit with having become a political scientist, which is a very secular field? And it certainly doesn't much deal with religion, at least unless it's doing studies of religious war in the Middle East or somewhere like that. And it took me some many years to begin to sort of unify these two sides of my life, and the book that's coming out in November is the first project or result of that. But I think it's pretty obvious to anybody who reads the papers or looks at television or reads the news online that the United States, which in the post-war years scholars were confidently predicting an American century where all of the major conflicts in society were resolved and we had nothing but prosperity ahead of us, didn't come to happen. Something went wrong. And with the shutdown in Washington, the something that has gone wrong has gone rather spectacularly wrong. What's going on? And it turns out, I think, that not only do spiritual issues enter into it in a very important way, but an inherited way we have of thinking about politics and society that has its own spiritual roots, although they're not just spiritual roots, there are other causes as well, are helping to make matters a good deal worse. Hence the title about getting beyond thinking about dichotomies. We love to think in dichotomies, and part of it, I think, is built in. We have on the one hand and on the other. Now, if we were intelligent octopuses, I don't think we would be thinking in dichotomies nearly as often, because it'd be eight hands. So we have a little bias in that direction anyway. Our electoral system encourages thinking in dichotomies because it makes it almost impossible for more than two parties to exist for very long. When we elect people through a plurality election, whoever gets the most votes wins, rather than majority, whoever gets a majority wins. What that means is if you vote for a third party and it doesn't win, you may as well have voted for the major party you like least. And so that makes it very hard for third parties to amount to much. And when they do, they're usually built around a personality. And when that personality leaves, so does the third party. Think of what happened to the Greens nationally when Ralph Nader was no longer associated with it. And think of the harm that Ralph Nader arguably did in the election in helping George Bush, who was farthest from Nader in views, to win. So many people don't want to vote for a third party for that reason. So we think in terms of Republicans, Democrats, on the one hand the Republicans, on the other hand the Democrats. And we also tend to think of it because I think our spiritual tradition is very much a dichotomous one. There's good and evil, God and devil. You know, his plan and the devil as the opponent to his plan. So a lot of our culture encourages thinking in terms of dichotomies. And thinking in dichotomies does not help us get clear on what's going on in the United States today. If anything, it makes it harder to understand. The usual way of putting it is liberalism versus conservatism, or maybe it's liberal Democrats, conservative Republicans, terms like that. And then people talk about, well, we want somebody in the middle who can harmonize both. It doesn't really give us much clarity for a number of reasons, and so I want to put a third pole power as domination, and then explain why. But to do that, we first have to get clear what is a liberal and what is a conservative. And normally I would say, does anybody have definitions? I hope you'll pardon me because I have a lot of words and I want to get it over in time for your questions and stuff if I just play professor for a while. But if a question comes up, or if you have, I say something that seems really wrong or confusing to you, please let me know. Okay. Liberalism, historically, is rather interesting. It preceded conservatism as a political and social philosophy. Its founder, pretty much everybody agrees, was a man named John Locke. And Locke lived during the period of religious war in England and on the continent. Spent part of his time in exile in Holland, so he wouldn't get killed in England, and that's where he learned about religious toleration, because that was the only place that really practiced it, at least for most religions. And as a consequence of that war and the kinds of problems they had in England with governmental power and revolution, Locke ended up writing two treatises of government that appeared in 1689. Many years later, about 100 years later, Edmund Burke wrote what is usually regarded as the foundation of serious conservative political thought, Reflections on the Revolution in France, and that appeared in 1790, after the American Revolution, which, interestingly enough, and we'll get into why, he supported. A classic statement of liberal principles is the opening of our own Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Every idea in that preamble is developed at length in Locke's work, his second treatise in particular. In fact, it's so similar that some people say, well, Jefferson must have cribbed from Locke. Jefferson himself said he didn't try to be original at all. He tried to describe the general thinking of the men he was associated with. So this was a very liberal revolution at the level of its leaders. Locke, in addition, however, was also rather extraordinary for his time in arguing that women had the same rights as men, and that indeed children had rights against their parents. So if anyone wants to say, well, where did this notion of kids' rights come from? It came from the guy who inspired our Declaration of Independence. They were pretty extraordinary views for the time, and indeed in parts of this country they would still be extraordinary views. He could be called an early feminist. Liberalism's principles then are that all people are equal, not necessarily in talents, but in rights or in moral standing. Given that people are unequal in talents, in luck, and opportunity, the inevitable result of free and equal men and women acting for themselves is inequality, and liberalism has always tried to solve that particular tension. And they've done it in different ways. Initially, they pretty much, liberals generally thought it would be, well, we want small farmers owning their own land, therefore nobody can boss them around, and they can be self-governing. That was the ideal. But when a liberal society was established in America, something very different happened. We got big cities, mass demise, the rise of large businesses and of a market economy, an increase in the role of science and in invention. And these were all problems that liberals like Locke or Jefferson and Madison had never anticipated. And so American society, which was the most liberal in the world, and liberals for the most part didn't have to defend themselves against others, split. As this paper did. No, I can turn paper buttons. Maybe I can't. And in the American context, it's different in Europe. In the American context, liberalism split in three different ways. We usually think of classical liberals say, well, actually liberalism split between us, we're the real liberals, and the so-called liberals are socialists or something like that. This is self-serving hooey, to use a really technical term. And what happened was much more interesting. Liberals basically split based on their way of evaluating the three major institutions that arose out of liberal society that nobody had fully anticipated: capitalism, mass democracy, and science. All grew out of liberalism, all are liberal institutions, and all created different sets of strengths and weaknesses. Classical liberals basically are what could be called Goldwater conservatives. Almost everybody here is of my generation or close to it, so we all remember Goldwater conservatives. The early Ronald Reagan's rhetoric in particular as well. They're advocates think of Milton Friedman, F.A. Hayek, free markets, laissez-faire capitalism, this kind of thing. Libertarians often claim to be classical liberals. And what they have from the original liberalism is a deep distrust of government and governmental power, and a deep support for private property, and in certain senses the rule of law, and their own view of what a constitutional government is. But liberalism was more than that. If you read Locke, or you look at the Declaration of Independence, or read the preamble to the Constitution, it's not just that. And so other liberals were concerned with the rise of giant businesses and the fact that they were subordinating many people to the power of enormous economic inequality. In fact, America has the most violent labor history of any major country. And a lot more laborers died in that than anybody else. And so you also had liberals who thought, well, we have a democratic government. It's not a monarchy or an aristocracy anymore. We can use that to regulate business, and with the tools of modern science, we can create a society in greater service to human well-being. And their first major time in the history books was as progressives. I call them managerial liberals. They gave us the civil service for even-handed, depoliticized administration. They're the people who came up with the New Deal, with the great dams and public works projects that were built. The civil service and regulatory agencies, all of them pretty much reflect this idea that expertise in a democratic environment can be used to solve the problems of inequalities of power and wealth that capitalism generates. Okay. Historians like to say the progressive movement was incoherent. Well, it wasn't. It was that there were three different approaches by liberals. And the third, the egalitarian liberals, gave us, here in California, which was one of the most progressive states in the country, the initiative, the referendum, and the recall. None of them make a civil servant's life any easier. None of them depoliticize administration. They do the opposite. And so this was a very different approach. They gave us primaries so that the average person could have a greater say in who the political candidates were, given that we were only going to have two parties. And what united them was their opposition to big business. But their solutions tended to be different. And the progressives, who were egalitarian, tended to succeed at state levels. At the national level, the managerial liberals did. How are they all liberals? All support private property. They just defined what it should include in different ways. All support a market economy. All support the ideal of the rule of law applying equally to everyone, but disagree as to what should fall under its oversight. All, in this sense, regard the individual as the fundamental moral unit of society. None support abolishing private property. None believe power should determine what is lawful. None want to create a centrally planned economy. And so, what are said to be by the classical liberals, the people who kept the name liberal are not really liberals, is false. None of them reflect the original liberal ideal fully. Why? Because they're addressing problems the original liberals never dreamt would ever be problems. Time changes. Okay, that's liberalism. What's conservatism? Conservatism rose in reaction to the failure of the French Revolution. Edmund Burke lived during the time of the American Revolution and supported it for conservative reasons. two quotations give a good taste of what a conservative support of the American Revolution would be like. He's telling Parliament, where he served, "Leave America if she has taxable matter in her to tax herself. I am not here going into the distinctions of rights, nor attempting to mark their boundaries." There he's criticizing liberalism. "I do not enter into those metaphysical distinctions. Leave the Americans as they anciently stood. And these distinctions, born of our unhappy contest, will die along with it. Be content to bind America by laws of trade. You have always done it. Do not burden them with taxes, but if you poison the very source of government by urging subtle deductions and consequences odious to those you govern, from the unlimited and illimitable nature of supreme sovereignty," he did like to write that purple prose, "you will teach them to call that sovereignty itself into question. If that sovereignty and their freedom cannot be reconciled, they will cast your sovereignty in your face." So he's predicting the American Revolution there, if the Brits continued with their policies, which they did. He also argued, quote, "The people of the colonies are descendants of Englishmen. They are therefore not only devoted to liberty, but to liberty according to English ideas and on English principles. The people are Protestants, a persuasion not only favorable to liberty, but built upon it." Okay, what's going on here? Liberals emphasize equal rights. Conservatives avoid that kind of talk completely. And they distrust abstract theoretical models. They argue each of us is primarily exists within a historical and cultural context that defines our rights. Each of those contexts has to develop on its own. So a Burkean conservative is not going to get particularly upset about, say, why women's rights in Saudi Arabia don't resemble their rights over here. That's the Saudis' problem. They have to solve it in the Saudi context. The last thing we would do would go into a country like Iraq and try to make them more like us. It can't be done. We're always social beings of time and place. We can improve it through piecemeal changes or risk disaster by opposing all change, or by seeking to create a better world by imposing untried institutions. Okay.
Man.
Yeah.
So I just want to get see if I understand this. For a Burkean conservative, rights are not God-granted and inalienable. They're part of a historical.
Mm-hmm.
They're based on historical precedent,
right.
Cultural heritage.
Right.
Okay. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. And if it's only a little broke, even then, you better be careful, because if you try to fix it, you might make a big break. Now, interestingly, this is ecological reasoning. This is the argument ecologists use about human beings try to control nature. The world is complex. Too complex for us to simply turn into, say, agricultural monoculture, or try to replace natural forest with a tree plantation. So there's a very, very interesting and mostly unexplored connection between conservative, genuinely conservative reasoning coming out of Burke, and you could trace it back to Hume if you wanted to, but that tradition also is the same kind and style of thinking that ecologists use, most ecologists. Now, it seems to me one of the interesting implications here is that they are not opposites. This is not what's going on. That is, I imagine, as I was describing conservative reasoning, many of you here found a certain appeal to it and logic. And I imagine as I was describing liberal reasoning, many of you here found a certain appeal to it and logic. At least I hope so. And yet they're not contradictory. They're looking at society from two vantage points. That is, you can believe that there are eternal moral principles in the universe and still be aware that our ability to live those principles cannot simply be imposed by new laws or reading a book, that a society has to develop in order to be able to achieve those outcomes. And most people are not going to be pure liberals or pure conservatives. They're going to have mixes of these kinds of thinking. Leave that for the moment. And it worked for the American Revolution because it rebuilt on established English customs and institutions and applied liberal institutions to or liberal ideals to defend and reform them. And it worked. By contrast, the French did not have institutions that were easily open to liberal ideals. It was much more hierarchical. The monarchy was absolute, or at least claimed to be absolute. The British monarchy had been put into power by Parliament. And the French aristocracy was much more divorced from everybody else in France than the English aristocracy was. It was a very, very different kind of situation. The rule of law in France was much weaker than it was in Britain. And so it was sort of like saying, well, let's just have the Iraqis adopt the American Constitution and see what happens. It would not be a pretty sight. But it worked over here. So I want to suggest that liberalism and conservatism, far from being opposites, are symbionts. They're symbiotic in their relationship. They illustrate different parts of what a human society is. And the third concept begins, I think, to help put some light on it. Both liberalism and conservatism distrust arbitrary power. And when I say conservatism, I mean Burkean through Goldwater conservatism. What we call conservatism today, I think we'll see, is not conservative at all. Something very different. It was the British Crown's claims to power that led to both the Declaration of Independence and Burke's support of the revolution. But power, as domination, seeks to subordinate all principles to its rule. That is, it can use, those seeking power alone, can use liberal rhetoric to achieve it, or conservative rhetoric to achieve it, or any other kind of rhetoric to achieve it. Because principles are nothing but tools in the search for power. Liberals talk of rights as limitations on power. Conservatives talk of tradition and prudence as limitations on power. And against these principles, power puts will. It wants to dominate. It wants to tell people what to do. That's its reason for existence. Okay, this three-way, what I call three poles, gives us a better understanding of what's going on in politics, that you have two orientations towards society, both of which distrust power. They're very good at seeing how power uses the other to centralize and control. They're not very good at seeing how they themselves get used by power to centralize and control. So very often the conservatives make pretty good critiques of liberals, and liberals make pretty good critiques of conservatives. The American context was different in another interesting way. Conservatives want to support the pre-existing institutions. And America's pre-existing institutions, especially after the Revolution, were all liberal. So you have the odd situation of conservatives trying to support institutions rooted in liberal ideas, and that's what made it so easy for a Goldwater conservative to ally with a classical liberal. And why conservatives and classical liberals at one time tended to be, you know, sort of blurred from one to the other. The term they used to describe themselves, they called fusionists. And that was back when National Review first got going in the 50s and 60s. Okay. How does this relate to giving a talk at Many Rivers? You know, it's not immediately terribly obvious. I want to suggest that both liberalism and conservatism were deeply in debt to Western Christianity. Take liberalism. Despite its being defended today almost always in purely secular terms, liberalism is probably more in keeping with Jesus' teaching that all are equal in God's eyes than is any other modern ideology I know of. Consider Matthew 25, verses 34 through 40. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" And the king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." The important difference between this teaching and liberalism is that liberals stop at not aggressing against one another, but do not proclaim a duty to help one another. Locke came close in the second treatise. It can be read into creating institutions for the pursuit of happiness, but it was never a major theme, although as a theme it got smaller and smaller among classical liberals. You can find Jefferson writing how if things go well, the time will come when the poor pay no tax at all in the United States, and won't that be great? Not, they don't have any skin in the game. It's what we should look forward to. So early liberalism had a much sort of bigger heart than the classical liberals who most frequently talk about being in that tradition, but it was never really central, which is why it could be given up. By contrast, conservatism laid greater emphasis on how individuals differed in the social order. And so society had always been hierarchical. It wasn't going to go away. Trying to make hierarchies go away would simply result in worse hierarchies. But that didn't mean that the elites were anything special as people. Hierarchy was a social issue. It wasn't based on personal excellence. It was going to happen. And wise elites had a duty to look out for everybody else. The term noblesse oblige. And if you look, you know, say English style conservatives, which often had a Burkean root for much of their history, were often concerned with social welfare issues against the liberals in England. Why? if everybody has a stake in the system, nobody will want to fight the system. It's a very conservative approach. Make sure, the only way to make sure that my superiority is safe is to make sure that nobody has a vested interest in taking me down. It followed that those blessed with a privileged place should be of service to their broader society. This, of course, has very little to do with what is calls itself conservatism today for very interesting reasons. But in a way, conservatism and liberalism divided the Christian ethic in half. One emphasized equality, one emphasized responsibility to others. Although not so much for religious reasons as rational self-interest. They also had weaknesses. What I regard as a valid conservative criticism of liberalism was that it lacked the moral weight to replace Christianity as a foundation for society. Liberalism was too much a product of philosophy, and in the final analysis, could not really derive ethical principles from statements of fact. Something more was needed. As a liberalism secularized society, it was undercutting its own moral foundations. I would argue we're living with the consequences of liberalism having done that today. But if liberalism lacked moral weight, conservatism had a similar connected weakness. It arose in Great Britain. And unlike much of Europe, Britain was the most liberal country of the time. Its customs tended to be liberal. Burke's sympathies tended to be liberal, but for non-liberal reasons. Just as liberalism depended on its Christian roots, conservatism depended on English cultural and religious roots. Get rid of those English, of those cultural and religious roots, and conservatism has a problem because it privileges the status quo. And if the status quo loses those roots, conservatism simply becomes privileging those who currently have power. And here it becomes non-conservative, because the one thing we know in society, as in the world as a whole, and certainly conservatism with its ecological perspective knows this to be true too, is that change is always happening. And so if you try to prevent change, you have to use more and more power to preserve the status quo. And as you do, in a sense, you cease being conservative. You undermine the very principles of conservatism. Okay. Those are the problems that I think liberalism and conservatism had intrinsic, and the problems came to bite us as a nation because liberalism did wipe out its Christian foundations for a great many Americans, that is, especially with Darwin. Up until Darwin, Christians had a fairly easy time, most of them, reinterpreting the Bible as myth, as allegory, as symbolic descriptions in which they found deep spiritual truths. But the whole idea of the fall of Adam and Eve, of original sin, which is a Western Christian concept, don't fit Darwin very well at all. And it became a serious problem in European thought and American thought. The first philosopher to really see what was going on was a guy named Friedrich Nietzsche. Anybody here read Nietzsche? Okay. You know, he's famous for his statement, "The Death of God." He basically agreed with the conservative critique of liberalism, that liberalism didn't have the moral foundation to support a society, but he said the conservative answer, go back to God, won't happen because God is dead. There is no God. Nobody said it better than Nietzsche. And he predicted a time of war and revolution and extraordinary violence. He did it at a time when Europe was filled with optimists who thought things were just going to get better and better and better, and then World War I hit. And at the end of World War I, Nietzsche's stock had risen rather high, although he was dead, and you had the rise of nihilism, which is the philosophy that there are no values. And nihilists can take two forms, basically. One is, it's all pointless, there is nothing here that matters. It breeds a kind of passivity. And the other is, then we must use will to make our world the way we want it to be. And this was the, you can find people like Nietzsche, like Mussolini writing about Nietzsche in those terms. We are nihilists, and we will create a world of power. So nihilism, if it's going to be active at all, because there is no moral foundation, goes to power. All right. It didn't hit the U.S. until the 70s. We were insulated from World War I, we won World War II, we had the American prosperity after World War II. The 50s and 60s were times of optimism. I mean, you know, we think of the anti-war movement and all of that, but the thing to remember about that, everybody was, they might disagree with each other, but they all were fundamentally, except for the possibility of nuclear war, optimistic. You know, opportunities, the new left saw opportunities, the technocrats saw opportunities, the New Deal or the New Frontier people of the Kennedy administration saw opportunities. It was an optimistic time that started coming apart in the 70s with the stagflation, with of the Carter years, late Nixon and Carter, or Ford and Carter years, you know, the Vietnam debacle, the New Deal and egalitarian liberals pretty much lost confidence in their technical expertise, and they already had lost a lot of the moral foundation to fight for their views. I think there was a symbolic event when Michael Dukakis was debating George Bush Sr., and Bush accused him of being a liberal, which he was. And Dukakis could have said, yes, we gave you the week, we gave you the weekend, we gave you Social Security, we gave you Medicare, we gave you all of these things. You want to make something of it? You opposed all of that. The Republican Party opposed all of that. Civil rights, we gave. He could have made a powerful moral statement of how liberalism helped Americans. Instead, he tried to get out of it. He no longer had confidence in the liberal vision, the managerial and egalitarian. Well, he was more of a managerial liberal, but that kind of vision had seemed to fall apart between the inflation, the stagnation, Vietnam, didn't look good. And this meant that two of the three branches of liberalism essentially lost the energy to support and push their view of what was good and right. And there's an author that I can only recommend a lot named George Lakoff. He teaches at Berkeley, and he makes a point. Some of you have read Lakoff. L-A-K-O-F-F. He writes well. He's a superb lecturer if you get a chance to hear him talk. And he basically said, why is the right winning and the Democrats losing when if you do a poll of Americans on almost every concrete issue, they prefer the Democrats? Why is this happening? He said, because the right talks the language of values and morality. The left talks policy wonk. Democrats are wonks. Bill Clinton is a beautiful example. And people care about values. Once we agree about the values, then we'll talk about what policies might be best to get there. But if you don't talk about values and somebody else is, and somebody cares about, especially when they're talking about family, country, God, and they're not being challenged, except by wonkish debates, Lakoff said, you're going to lose. You're going to lose, pretty much always, because that's what motivates people. And so you had a sort of disempowering, a sort of passive nihilism, if you will, of liberalism. I wrote a, and this was also happening in liberal Christianity. It's funny, I wrote a piece not long ago that appeared online called The Myth of Monotheism, pointing out that there is no coherent monotheism, that in a sense, Christianity, for example, has so many different forms, you could call it serial monotheism, because the God of Calvin is certainly not the God of the Quakers, and nor the God of the Episcopals, nor the God of the Unitarians, although, well, they're not Christians, but in any event, they, well, it depends on which Unitarian you're talking to, but the point is, it's all over the place. And I got some comments from some people who claim to be ministers. Well, we know that. I said, it's funny how you haven't told your congregation that, to which there was no response. They no longer themselves believed in the firmness of the tradition in which they claim to be leading their congregations. So you have a passivity that didn't exist in the 60s. Interesting. I mean, if you look, the black church was supported. The black church is where the energy came from for the civil rights movement, but it was supported by a lot of progressive Christians and liberal Christians. They're pretty passive these days. Something is going on. But classical liberals, for a while, seem to have the edge. They still had their alliance with conservatisms, and so they were benefiting, and Friedman and especially and others were benefiting from the rise of a sort of classically liberal influence conservatism of Goldwater and Reagan. But that was about to change. They had their own encounter with nihilism. And I think there the interesting influence is Ayn Rand, who is the major vector in our society by which Nietzschean thought entered American culture at the popular level. And she has become the major voice of conservatism and of classical liberalism. And then you find Rand blurring into what calls itself conservatism today. So that you get this odd thing of Rand Paul claiming to be a Christian who admires Ayn Rand, a militant atheist. And you think, what? What's going on here? Something very interesting. And people will say, am I too harsh on Rand? There are a couple of good quotes, but the short one is from her first book, We the Living, when her heroine says, and this is pure Nietzsche, what are your masses but mud to be ground underfoot, fuel to be burned for those who deserve it? What is the people but millions of puny, shriveled, helpless souls who have no thoughts of their own, no dreams of their own, no will of their own, who eat and sleep and chew helplessly the words of others put into their mildewed brains? I know of no worse injustice than justice for all. This is the philosophy that underlies a great deal of secular, what we call classical liberalism or conservatism today, and it has no relationship to Locke, to the Declaration of Independence. It is nihilism. Nihilism. Jim.
I just wanted to add a footnote. When Rand's journals were published, I don't know, 5 to 8 years ago, she expressed admiration for a mass murderer in Los Angeles, you know, because he was exercising his will and you know, was imposing as well on other people. So I just thought I would.
Yeah,
you know,
she did not approve of what he did, but she was impressed by his will, by his ability to overcome any opposition. Okay. Superior people do not need others to impede their projects.
That's a good line.
You know, that's a summary. She did not say that. And that's why Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan would not be popular in today's conservative movement. It has become an individualistic American variant of right-wing authoritarianism that arose in Europe. They're not fascists. The difference is that the European authoritarian nihilists believed in collective principles, the race, the nation, something of that sort. And that gave it at least some kind of appearance of morality. That is something greater than the individual, that the individual was to sacrifice to. But, in fact, there's a fascinating book called Nazi Morality by Claudia Kuntz. Describes how Nazis actually thought of themselves as extraordinarily moral and principled people, and were sincere in doing so. Anyone wanting to understand today's right wing could benefit by reading that book. But Americans are not like that. You know, the Tea Partiers dress in every conceivable weird uniform, but they certainly don't wear brown shirts and march in straight lines. Why? They're much more individualistic. They come out of a liberal culture. But they have no deeper principles. They're nihilists and authoritarians. How did that happen? And here's where I think an interesting thing that sheds light on what's happening in Washington today. When our founding fathers' generation died in the South, almost all of them had been opponents of slavery. They didn't know how to get rid of it, but they didn't like it, and they hoped it would have disappeared by one means or another. Their sons, with the coming of the cotton gin, decided slavery was really a good institution because it made them an enormous amount of money. And yet they inherited a revolutionary tradition that was deeply opposed to slavery. What do you do with that? I mean, people forget that within a few years of the revolution, 8 states of the original 13 abolished slavery. And for a while, several of them allowed blacks as well as women to vote. New Jersey allowed any woman to vote. The others only if they were not married, so they could be widows or unmarried. They figured if they were married, they'd do what their husbands told them to do, which probably was not true any more then than now. But that was the rationale. But in many New England states, women could vote. And most feminists have forgotten that. So what happened? The South's major thinkers repudiated the Declaration of Independence's reasoning and looked for other arguments. Under the Declaration of Independence, states have no rights. People have rights. States serve them. Suddenly we're seeing talk about states' rights. That's a completely un-American concept. It is much more European, traditional European. Add to that, what happened to Southern religion? The Baptists in Jefferson's time were progressive. They supported separation of church and state. They supported a greater role for women in religion in many instances. But in the South, as the South became more committed to slavery and to the institutions that supported slavery, Southern religion changed. And it had to repudiate not only the North, it ultimately had to repudiate the Enlightenment. And where did they go? To the Bibles, read in ways where biblical parts supported slavery. And so you had what I call the creation of the first American counterculture in the antebellum South, that's still with us. It never became liberal after the Civil War. It continued in that culture. 100 years after the Civil War, I believe there were zero black members of the Southern Baptist religion. And yet for 100 years, they were relatively powerless. Why? Lincoln was a Republican. And so Southerners elected Democrats. But the Republicans were the conservative party, and the Democrats nationally increasingly were dominated by liberals. So you had Southern senators with enormous seniority because they never lost an election, but the Democratic political presidents tended to be liberal, and when you got enough Democrats in from Northern states, civil rights legislation was passed. This alienated Southern Democrats. Republicans under Nixon took the opportunity to pursue what they call their Southern strategy and try to bring Southern conservatives, so-called, into the Republican Party. And this achieved its true success with Ronald Reagan. But what they did, I call a deal with the devil. Why? Because the Southern conservatives were neo-Confederate conservatives. They were not American conservatives. They did not revere the Constitution. They revered the principles of the Confederacy. And the principles of the Confederacy were antithetical to the principles of the Constitution. And so you had the coming together of a classical liberal movement that was becoming less and less morally grounded, more and more egoistic nihilism, a religious tradition that had abandoned the humane dimension of Christianity and its God and worshipped only a God of power and subordination and looked upon all human relationships in those ways, with women properly at the bottom. And that religion had sent many missionaries into the Midwest in particular and been quite successful. And so you have the rise of an American nihilist movement that's roots are in the collapse of the Christian moral foundation in the West. As such, that's a very pessimistic analysis. Because if I'm right, traditional liberalism and traditional conservatism cannot heal itself. It doesn't have the moral and ethical strength to do so. But I am here in a religious bookstore. I do write books on religion. So I obviously have a somewhat different take on it. And that takes really... Let me describe a period and tell me when you think it is. The rise of new religious movements, the rise of women into greater prominence in religion, the rise of interest in nature for its own good, the rise of an interest in wild nature, creation of lots of utopian communities throughout the country, increased interest in Asian religion, increased interest in mysticism, the largest anti-war movement in American history, the rise of feminism, and the rise of concern with racial justice. What does that sound like?
The 60s.
It sounds like the 60s, but it's the 1840s. The 60s were nothing new. And in my view, what was happening, and it was happening primarily in the North from in the 1840s, 30s, 40s, 50s, was the creation of a new foundation for a democratic society rooted in liberal principles, in which what is good is rooted in the world. It's imminent in the world, not up there.
In fact, Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, when he visited the U.S. in the 40s, 1840s, liked what he saw, for the most part. But he was appalled at what he called the spread of pantheism. And he said, this seems to be connected to democratic societies. And while he liked democracy, and his book is truly a wondrous, wonderful two volumes, while he basically liked democracy, he said, this is something against which we good Catholics have to fight against fervently, because it's against God. That is, instead of up here, the sacred is all around us. And indeed, here's a nice description of a pantheistic point of view. Standing in the light, my life is a pantheist. I didn't write it. And in the 60s, what had been something of an elite movement suddenly became a mass movement. It's not surprising that Henry David Thoreau was sort of the patron saint of the 60s. I think we all of us who went through that period read Thoreau on civil disobedience or Walden. I mean, he was all over the place. And it was in the 60s that on a popular level, you started getting religions of eminence. And even in some of the traditional, like neo-pagans, such as myself, the sacred is in the world, manifests through the seasons, in through life and death, through male and female. And we build our rituals around it. But not just pagans. You see the same kind of thing happening in many Christian churches. They start celebrating seasonal events, the sacred in the world. Women start becoming ministers, rabbis, all over the place. Even in Buddhism, and Buddhism was as anti-woman as anything in Christianity. But David Chadwick, some of you might know him, he used to live, maybe he still does live in
Santa Rosa.
Okay. He moved a long way away, all the way from Sebastopol to Santa Rosa. But David has written a number of books on Buddhism. And I was talking with him once about this, and he said, yeah, half the Dharma teachers in the U.S. are women. And then in the Tibetan tradition, where traditionally the most senior nun has to prostrate herself before the most junior monk, and if she lives a good life, she'll be reborn as a man, so she might have a chance to become enlightened. The Dalai Lama has written, he calls himself a feminist, and most recently blew my mind when he said, the next Dalai Lama might be a woman. Something profound is going on. The dimensions of human beings most thoroughly rooted in the world, in the earth. Women have a connection with their biology none of us guys can ever fully appreciate, I think. And no man has to deal with menopause. I never heard any woman say it was fine. And, or all of the other more obvious aspects. So we're seeing a deep shift in Western American spirituality, I would argue. And it's a shift that can reconnect that's the wrong pen. Where's my big black pen? Oh well, it'll be red. It can reconnect liberalism and conservatism with a broader spiritual foundation. Conservatism is already sort of the original conservatism with its ecological way of thinking. What about liberalism? And I'll make it. You had a question.
I was just going to say, I have to leave right now, and it's horrible because I'm so into what you're saying. Is there a way that I can connect with you?
Sure. And but my book goes on into a lot of that, and it'll be out next month. But yes, you can connect with me through Jim.
What is your last name?
Dizeriga, D-I-Z.
Okay. Come on in this weekend, and we'll talk.
And I'll just touch on the liver side, and then we can throw it open, because I've talked a lot. And I've covered a lot of ground. You know, when I was writing, first working on this, okay, but how does liberalism, because liberalism is so deeply connected to Christianity. And Christianity is so deeply connected to a very different, I'm not going to say wrong, but a different approach to spirit. And then I thought of the arguments for animal rights. There are a lot of arguments for animal rights and animal liberation, and they all, to my mind, fall apart because they try to take the notion of a human right or human morality and apply it to forms of life that eat one another, which, as a rule, in liberalism, really is not into cannibalism. You know, never has been. And so, you know, Tom Regan, who wrote Animal Rights, the first animal rights book, said wolves violate the rights of deer. And you read that and say, Tom Regan violates the logic of life. And Peter Singer, with his utilitarianism, has similar problems. But if we look at pagan societies before control of nature became so central to agriculture, we find an alternative ethic that I think fits liberal rights just fine. And that is respect for all beings. What is a right? A right is the respect you have for an equal who is a stranger. Equal is the liberal principle. You don't have the same sort of respect for your dog or cat as you do for your closest friend. Even though, in some respects, your dog or your cat might be your closest friend. But they're not equal in the same sense. You can't have a relationship of equals at quite the same depth with our pets as we can with the people who are closest to us. So there is that difference. But a liberal right is not what you would do to a friend, or not how you would relate to a friend. For example, Jim and I have an argument, because sometimes he's wrong.
Awesome.
And now I cannot imagine Jim saying this, and I cannot imagine my doing it to Jim, but let's pretend for the sake of the moment that, I'd be more likely to do it than Jim because I'm more volatile than Jim is. And so we're having an argument, and I finally said, well, you just shut up. He says, don't talk to me that way. I say, I have a right to freedom of speech. I can talk to you any way I want. And he says, yes, but you're no longer my friend. That is, liberal freedoms are not completely compatible with intimate relationships. Or let's say, I'll pick me as the villain again, because it's more appropriate, I guess. I get totally, plus Jim doesn't drink, I get totally drunk, and we're talking. And at the end of it, and I can barely walk. No, I don't drink that much, but let's, for the sake of the argument, I can barely walk. And I get up to leave, and Jim says, and I call you a cab. No, no, I'll drive. I'll take you home. No, I want to go myself. He grabs my keys, violating my property rights, which are liberal rights. That's what a friend would do. And so liberal rights don't work for everybody. They work for strangers. As soon as we put that hat on, then suddenly both conservatism and liberalism are in complete harmony with spiritualities of sacred immanence, whether they be neo-pagan or some variants of Christianity or Buddhism or Judaism or anything else. And I want to suggest the solution to the moral crisis of the West is from precisely that move. A redefinition or a reconceiving of where spiritual truth is most accessible to most people, which is not up there, but around here. Hence the importance of meditation, of celebrating the seasons, of thinking ecologically, which people can do whether they be spiritual or even secular, as once people start looking at the world as a place of value, even secular scientists are finding animals have morality. My favorite example, I don't know if you have Mark Bekoff's Animal Morality here?
I don't know whether you do, I'd have to look it up.
Okay. Fascinating book, and one of the examples he gives, and this will be my final comment, a monkey is taught to press a bar and it gets food. Well, that's been done a lot. This monkey then notices that when he presses the bar to get the food, another monkey gets an electric shock. Once he noticed that, he didn't eat for 10 days. That's better than most people would do. I think I would say, okay, jump as high as you can to try to get the food, and hopefully the guy's feet will be off the ground. The monkey just wouldn't eat. That would be, most of us would call, a very moral act, and there are apparently quite a few examples of that. So the world, even for secular people, but I think here the spiritual grounding is particularly important for people who come to a store like this. And I think here is where we see hope for the future. And with that, I'll open it up to what anybody wants to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
My book will be out in November. We'll go into all of this in great much detail.
So I have a question.
Oh.
And the question is, it seems like you're making a dichotomy between the immanentist and, as you were saying, up there. And where responsibility, where meaningful responsibility lies. And you're arguing that the immanentist view has responsibility residing in our relationship to the co-creation that we're a part of here, as opposed to some idea of a deity above us. Is that a fair restatement of I want to see if I'm understanding.
Almost. The difference is that the immanentists, some, and I'm one, have no problem with saying there is also a transcendent dimension, but the world is not separate from it. The world is not meaningless. The world is not fallen. The world is not, in some sense, separated in a fundamental way from the spiritual. It's an expression and manifestation of the spiritual.
Okay, so the distinction you're making is in claiming that what you're saying, I think, is that formerly responsibility to God was the primary, the relationship with God was the primary thing, and that's how people would understand the basis of morality.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is that the relationship to God is enacted through our relationship with our environment.
Yeah. I had a really fascinating encounter with a young evangelical missionary at Starbucks up the road. And he said that you needed God in order to act right. If he didn't believe in God, there's no telling what he would do. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I know atheists who act right, and they have no belief in God or even of an afterlife. Apparently, you believe in, you know, you do good things so God can pay you off afterwards. You want to be paid well. I said, most of the people I know, that's not part of their motivation at all. And I think that, in a sense, is the point, that when you have a purely transcended model, the world is without meaning, all value comes from up there. If that's not there, there is no value, and anything goes.
What did he say to that?
He didn't have an answer. And I thought,
you mentioned Darwin. Could you say anything about how he's misinterpreted today and used in politics? And
there's a whole book. Darwin was not a social Darwinist. In fact, one of his books was about how morality arises naturally out of the world. He has a lot in common with sort of the Scottish Enlightenment people, like Adam Smith in his book on sympathy. You know, people forget about that. They think they know what Smith said because he wrote The Wealth of Nations. They never read it. They did, they would have a different view. But his other major book was called
Ethic?
No. These senior moments. Anyway, it's his other major book. And it's all about the importance of sympathy, or what we would today call empathy, because it didn't really mean, and the words have shifted their meaning, in morality. And so that whole tradition Darwin built on. And so the notion that the selfish gene, it's not Darwinian. And it's interesting that one of the two originators of the selfish gene hypothesis, E.O. Wilson, his new book is called The Social Conquest of Nature. He repudiates, and it takes a lot of guts for a scientist to repudiate a theory that made him famous. That doesn't happen very often. Wilson repudiates it. I was wrong that the most successful evolutionary strategies are social, are cooperative. It's as you see it in humans, in ants, in bees, in termites. You know, these are the really super successful species. And this is why. And so that's in harmony with what Darwin would have anticipated. He was a very humane man. He was horrified by slavery, held slave owners in total disgust, and was opposed to vivisection of animals. In fact, he hoped that the theory of evolution, rather than causing people to treat people as animals, which is what some people did, would lead to our being more humane in our treatment of animals, because they're like us in important respects. Which again we're seeing with like Beckhoff's book on animal morality. It's called Wild Justice, is the name of the book. It's not very long, and it's fascinating.
Beckhoff,
B-E-K-O-F-F, first name Mark. I think he wrote it with a woman, but he was the major author. Yeah, it's a good title. So yeah, you're totally right. Darwin was misinterpreted even by as much by some of his fans as by some of, as by many of his foes.
The law of radical equality says set no one, nothing above or below you. See the same one moving in the life of everything that lives. It's for me, I see it as an intersection between the spiritual and the political. And it's part of a it's the point of the spirituality of conversation, where conversation itself becomes spiritual practice, and it brings practice into the moment, where you're kind of guarding the equality of all of the members of the conversation at once. I wonder if that speaks to the concern that you're describing.
For those able to truly do that, most of us have a little bit too much ego involvement to be able to consistently practice that. I would call it a principle, not a law, but the the thing is, as soon as you take that approach, you turn your back on domination.
Yes.
And as soon as you turn your back on domination, you are looking in this direction: spirit, love, compassion, this sort of thing.
So the ego is involved in this thing. Huh?
Hmm?
So the ego is involved in this thing. Then, huh?
I don't see how it couldn't be.
Mm.
My own personal theology, if you will, is that we need egos to learn how to love. That's another talk, but the loving is to value something other than you for what it is or who it is.
Mm.
Therefore, loving, I argue, requires duality and requires a degree of separation. If I love you, I love you not for how you're like me, but for how you are like you, which in some ways is like me, but in other ways that I may truly be delighted by is different. And using that terminology, God is able to love everybody in the ways that they are, for who they are, in all of their detail, with their warts as well as their strengths. So that's my so I don't look askance at the ego in the sense of a separate self that is in some sense different from you. My favorite, when I was a college kid at the University of Kansas, I told Jim this story a few days ago. I walked into the local beer bar, the Bierstube, and end up in the men's room, because that happens if you're at a beer bar for very long and you're a man. And they're written on the wall, or on the ceiling actually, along with the usual kinds of graffiti, was a fragment of a poem by Yevgeny Yevtushenko that, in retrospect, was one of the most important events of my life, reading that graffiti. And what the person had written was, I don't have it memorized, and I've told the story enough, I'd better, but when a man dies, there dies with him. No. When a man dies, it's not just a man who dies. There dies with him his first snow, his first kiss, his first fight. When a man dies, a world dies with him. Now, of course, he was Soviet era, and you know, he had to die. But with a somewhat different view of consciousness, you could say the individual creates a world. And as such, each of us is creating a world. And one we share with people who are like us in important respects, but probably not too much with somebody like Dick Cheney. But he's got his world. And that, to me, is the best description of why individuals are valuable that I'd ever read. because each it creates a world through consciousness and interpretation and their relationships and everything else. And as such, you need, you know, individuals are an important part of spiritual reality. So that's my own view, based on my own experiences. I had no idea when I read that graffiti that that's where it would lead, but it did. That was, what, 45 years ago, or more. Almost 50 years ago, not quite. Yes?
In the philosophy of immanence, where is profit?
What kind of profit? That is, profit could simply mean gain, and if so, perhaps we've all profited from this gathering. I would like to think
okay,
we have.
Well, then I guess I would have to say capitalist profit.
Boy, that's a complicated one. Let me tell two stories to try to point at the point. When I was earning my PhD at Berkeley, I didn't have enough money to write my dissertation. So I started my own business as an artist. I usually draw a little better than this. And I became a pretty good pen and ink artist, selling. Any of you guys in Berkeley 20 years ago? Do you remember a guy selling stationery and envelopes where there'd be pen and ink work on the envelope as well as the papers selling on Telegraph Avenue?
Because I've heard you, I think I sort of have a vague recollection.
Okay.
But
I was that guy.
Yeah.
So I was a street vendor as well as having a wholesale business. I had a small payroll, but it never made enough that I didn't have to go sell on Telegraph myself. But at least my office got paid for. And, okay, I made profit. And it freed me to do all the things I wanted to do, so long as I kept that business profitable. But I could choose what to sell it for. And so if a pagan came by, after I became a pagan, I gave them a lower price. The pagan special price, things like that. And then there was the friend price, and that was a lower price. And, you know, so there was the official price, and then there was variations. All of them went down. That business helped me write my dissertation, live my life. That profit contributed to my freedom. I see no moral problem with that profit in anybody's life. There's also the profit of a corporation, where if I'm a CEO, or you're a shareholder, and the corporation is doing something that we are morally troubled by, if I say stop as CEO, and the profit goes down as a result, the chances are very good that I will be ousted in an unfriendly takeover. That is, for me, the profit is not a source of freedom. It's a command. And if I obey those commands well enough, they pay me well for it. If I don't obey those commands well, I'm out. But if you're a shareholder, this is your private property, your share, and I, as CEO, am doing things that you find morally objectionable, so you don't control the corporation, because you don't control enough shares. So perhaps you don't want to be associated with it anymore. So you sell your shares. You sell them to somebody who's not bothered by what the corporation is doing and will therefore benefit from the profit. In other words, by doing the moral thing with your so-called private property, you're penalized in private property terms. So corporate capitalism, I would argue, is an intrinsically amoral to immoral operation. But being a business person, being an entrepreneur, need not be immoral or amoral at all. It can be a wonderful thing. It depends on whether you are in control of your business or your business is in control of you. Yeah, but it needn't be. That is, many a business person, not a corporation, but many a business person, and occasionally corporations can do it too if they're still dominated by either their founder with who has a set of strong values or has created a culture that reflects his or her values, and it hasn't yet been eroded away by the share market. For example, Starbucks. The guy who started Starbucks was named Schultz, I think. Schultz, Schultz, something like that. He grew up in a family that suffered from lack of medical care. Consequently, if you work for Starbucks, you get a very good medical program. His moral commitment. At one point, Starbucks entered a rough stretch financially. And all of the MBAs and what have you from business school that he'd hired to help run the company said, this gives you a good excuse to get rid of all that wasted money. He said, no, I won't. He controlled his business. His business reflected his values. And on that issue, at least, his values were anything but exploitive. So the thing about being a businessman is that your business reflects who you are, for good or for bad. And there are certainly jerks who are businessmen, but there are also wonderful people who are. And then we can go a step farther, and I'm talking, I think, next week for Science Buzz at the French Garden on this. There are things like the Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain or Alvarado Street Bakery in Petaluma, where the workers own the business. And so, just to give one teaser, last year, the average income for a worker who's a baker is about between $25,000 and $30,000 a year, according to what I could find out on Google. Different sources, but they all pretty much were in that neighborhood. Last year, the worker owners at Alvarado Street Bakery pulled in $80,000 plus a month's vacation. Not too shabby. Beats anything I ever made in academia. Well, I got a longer vacation, but nowhere close to that kind of money. And so it's hard to say there's exploitation there. It needn't be. It often is. And that get, and there are complex historical reasons for it. Our first businesses, our first textile mills in the U.S. were built before we had huge amounts of immigrants, of poor immigrants coming over from Europe. And so the only people they could hire were basically the daughters of farmers. And these farmers had their own farm. They didn't have to come. So they had to pay these women decent wages, clean housing. And in fact, I think the first newspaper edited by a woman in the United States was in Lowell, Massachusetts, which was a company town built to create textiles. And so our first textile firms were very, very, by the standards of the time, good at treating their workers. Then you got mass immigration. Suddenly the market for workers is overflowing. And so the market said, why pay these people this much money when we can pay these, buy these, or pay these starving immigrants pennies? And that's what happened, and we ended up with not only the most violent labor history in the world, but there were cases where owners would lock their employees in a building during working hours, and in one case the building caught fire and hundreds of young women died, and the owners paid a fine. So it ends up being a complicated thing because you have the logic of exchange plus the historical conditions in which it occurs. And even there, Spain today in the Mondragon Cooperative, Spain has 25% unemployment. The 80,000 worker owners of the Mondragon Cooperatives have 0% unemployment. And when I was there, it was middle class region. There was no, I saw no poverty, and I saw no gated communities. It was all prosperous middle class. So there's lots of possibilities in what capitalism or markets can do. Some of them hideous, some of them really quite wonderful. At least that's been my experience. As I say, if I couldn't have been a businessman, I wouldn't be here today. In fact, if I hadn't been a businessman, I wouldn't have dared the guy to show me magic that led to all of the events that led to me be here today, because he was one of my customers. And he claimed to be a magician, and I thought, oh, God, another Berkeley loon. Mm. But he's a good customer, so I'll keep my mouth shut. And then when I thought I wasn't going to be doing that anymore, I dared him. And the rest is history. So I think I've been signaled that it's time for me to shut my mouth and turn it over
to the lunacy of me.
The lunacy of this man instead of the lunacy of this man. Thank you.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Gus, on behalf of Mentors. It was wonderful, enjoyable, enlightening, entertaining, and I'm very grateful.
I'm glad it was entertaining.
Good. So, you, many of you know the drill here. We have a donation bowl over on the counter over there, the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. And we ask that you contribute to it, because we share that the proceeds from that bowl with our speakers to help maintain and further their work, and also to help maintain and further this space. And I wanted to point out, as I did not earlier, that we have books here, some of which are the books of our speaker, for example. And so we've got some, one of the ones here for you to take a look at by him and others. So check those out on your way out. And thank you so much for coming to Many Rivers Books and Teaching.
Thank you.
Very good.